Session number 27464, Martin Lamb, Reel 1.
Now, it's perhaps best to start right at the beginning. Can you tell me when you were born and where you were born?
Yes, I was born in Stoke Newington, which is in North London, on the 10th of March 1920.
And what did your father do?
My father, because of my name, L.A.M., is because my father was a Dutchman, and he'd come over as a boy, and well, there's a story there, but I won't bother you with it. He, in fact, came over for his sister's wedding. He missed it because he was going around London on top of a bus. But he stayed, and they apprenticed him to a barber. And, in fact, he was in hairdressing.
And where did he work? In Stoke Newington?
Well, I don't know where he worked at that time, but he had shops in various places, and we moved eventually to Hendon, which I remember well. And I went to school in Hampstead from Hendon. Anyhow, that's...
What school did you go to?
A school called University College School, which is in Hampstead. It's still there, and it's a nice place.
And how... did you have time to go to university?
Yes, I did. I got a scholarship to Caius College, Cambridge, and I went there in 1938, and left to go into the army in 1940, having volunteered because, well, in those days one did. I remember the head of the college was the physicist Chadwick, who invented, I think he found the neutron, or perhaps it was the proton, and he told us that we were lucky to be there and we may not last the full course, which we didn't.
What was Cambridge like during that year?
Oh, it was fairly normal.
Did you feel fairly isolated from what was going on?
Well, there wasn't a great deal going on because it was after Dunkirk. Dunkirk took place, I suppose, when I was still in Cambridge, or perhaps during the vacation. I can't really remember. I think that we just went on working. The first year was, well, not trouble-free, but at any rate, we hadn't these preoccupations. And the second year we knew we wouldn't probably finish our course. But otherwise, I think Cambridge was fair. There was no rationing, as far as I remember, at that time. When we went back, there was rationing, and we had to eat more in hall and so on. But as far as I remember, it was fairly, well, it was normal.
And how did you come to join the army?
Well, I volunteered. I'd been in the OTC.
At office, school?
Yes, at school. And I'd been in the signals. I can't help observing that it was quite different, of course, from what it was in the real signals. We had very little equipment, but I did in fact learn the Morse code, and we used to use flags and so on. We even had heliographs, which we could not use. They use the sun's rays to send messages. But I did learn the Morse code, and I suppose I took whatever certificate it was that you took to show you knew how to march and shout orders and all that irrelevant stuff. So when I eventually joined the army, I was received into the Royal Signals, which I was pleased to do, because in fact I liked the technical side of it, and it was very interesting work.
Where did you do your initial training?
My initial training was in Catterick. I think they got together a number of people who were, in the cliche, I hate to use it, but officer material or something, and we were put in a squad in Catterick. We went there on the 18th of July 1941, or was it 1940? No, it was 1940. And we were given the usual training, but we also had given training in, of course, physics and electricity and the rest of it. Have you got time for another little anecdote?
Yes.
We had a Corporal Locke, and he got us in there the first day in this lecture room, you see, and he said, we were all soldiers, and we were all dressed in fairly ill-fitting khaki, but there it was. And he says, well, he says, we've got 2 weeks to do the whole of electricity and magnetism, And I shall have a guard duty. I shall be guard commander during that time, which means 24 hours on and 24 hours off. And then you'll be doing, each of you will be doing the guard during that time, 24 hours on and 24 hours. Then you'll have TAB inoculations, which means 24 hours off. And then we're bound to have a ceremonial parade, which is half a day to prepare and half a day. And he went on like this, and he said, so we've only got, I think he worked it out, there's Sunday. Then there were Sundays and church parade. And he said, I think he ended by saying, so we've got about 6 days to do the whole of electricity and magnetism. And we did, ending with alternating currents, which were difficult. And after he'd given us a lecture on those, he said, well, everybody understand that? And there was a bit of a silence. And then a jock, one of our fellows, said, well, I understand it, Corporal, but I don't believe it. And if you know anything about sine waves and all that sort of thing, it's quite unrelated to what actually appears to be happening, you see. So it was anyway, so I did that. You can cut that out, I hope, if you want to. So I did my training, and eventually I was sent, after Catterick, I was sent to Aldershot for the OCTU course. I was delayed because my father was a Dutchman, and the authorities, you know, were making sure that, because Holland by that time had been overrun, and I suppose, because the only other man who was held up that long was a man of Italian, Cataldi, anyway, a man of Italian descent, about whom they were obviously also making inquiries. What kind of inquiries, I don't know. So eventually
Were you aware at the time of inquiries being made?
No. I just guessed, and so did he, that we were being held up for some, you know, security reason. And eventually I was sent to the OCTU, and I did my training, and I think I was posted from the OCTU in the summer of 42 to Air Formation Signals, which was a unit which provided land communications for the RAF. And it used mostly on teleprinter, no Morse, and it had to be landlines. And I went in November 1942 to North Africa. We landed in Algiers, and it's only since, sorry, I won't waste your time, but it's only since then that I've seen, you know, on film what shenanigans there were leading up to this invasion. Well, it wasn't really an invasion, a landing, and the doings of Robert Murphy, the American who fixed it all, and Macmillan actually was there as representing the British government. But I didn't see anything of that. We just did our job. We had a signal office in the St. George Hotel. I'd forgotten it was the St. George Hotel, in fact, until I happened to see the St. George Hotel mentioned on the television news. And another thing I will tell you, which is quite, I suppose, it's amusing, it's been in my mind. At some point, we had to set up a teleprinter switchboard. In other words, there were teleprinters in various places, and we would have a switchboard whereby they could talk to one another. There were teleprinters at various airfields. There was one at Blida, one at Maison Blanche, which was another airfield, and they'd all need to talk to us and to headquarters and to one another. And we had a sergeant who was a post office man. There were a lot of post office men in this unit. By the way, is this irrelevant?
No,
I see. There were a lot of post office men. It was a special reserve unit, and they were marvellous people. I mean, they knew their job like anything. Another parenthesis. Because the educational system wasn't then what it is now, there were people who could have gone to university in present-day circumstances, who didn't, and who went into the post office, say, at 16, and they became something called SC&T, Sorting, Clerical, and Teleprinter Operators. And these were extremely good people. I mean, they could do their job, they were serious people, and they could I learned touch typing from them. I can still do it, I'm glad to say. It's very useful on a computer, because the thoughts go straight, if they're lucky, from the brain to the fingers. Anyway, we had to set up this teleprinter switchboard, and we had a colonel who was from the post office, but he was from the postal side, rather looked down on by the technical people. And I discussed with him where we should put this teleprinter switchboard, which was quite a rarity in its way. And the chaps had told me two things. One, it must be placed in such a way that the operator, the man who was working the teleprinter, could see the people in the teleprinter room and therefore show them they were on or off. And secondly, it must be placed in such a way that you could easily get at the back of the machine, because the various relays had to be adjusted and the rest of it, you see. So I'd made a diagram of the room and of the teleprinters and a cutout of the teleprinter switchboard. And I told Colonel Scott about what I wanted to do and where I would like to put it. And he said, no, we'll have it there. And I've no idea now why he wanted it there. So I said, but sir, you know, we chaps can't get at the back of the wall. They will, they'll manage. He wanted it to be more conspicuous, I think, when people came in. Anyway, we had to put it there. So that's a parenthesis. So I worked there for a while. Then,
where precisely were you?
In Algiers.
In Algiers.
This was in Algiers. Yes. How did it happen? Oh, I know. After this service. Oh, by the way, there wasn't. You haven't asked me this, but there wasn't much enemy activity at that time. What I do remember also, when I first went, before I went to Algiers, I was at the airport called Maison Blanche, and we had a bit of bombing. But apart from that, oh, I have a piece of paper somewhere of two teleprinter operators, one who was being bombed and the other one who wasn't, and says, what's going on, mate? And he said, there's some shit falling here, says this other man. I've got that tucked away somewhere. I'm willing to give it to you. It's a real piece of paper. Anyhow.
Was that the first enemy action that you had seen?
Yes, it was. I think there was a bit of bombing, but only a bit, when we landed in Algiers. And one of our fellows, his name was Dart, was, I think, blown off the quay by a bomb and was never seen again. But apart from that, it was reasonably quiet.
But that bombing sounds quite close.
Oh, it was. It was. I mean, we had to go and make sure that the planes, because they were also at Maison Blanche, obviously the Germans were attacking the planes, and there was quite a risk that some of them would blow up, and the bombs could have been, there could have been a bomb hazard, but it didn't come to anything. Yes, I could go on about Algiers and the rest of it, but I think that's not what you're...
Well, it is quite...
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, it was curious. Leaving aside all the political complications, there was the assassination of...
Darlan,
who was the first leader picked. And then there were various others. And, of course, de Gaulle was not in favour at the time, and they made little of him. But I do remember that there was a general called Catroux, C-A-T-R-O-U-X, and there was a joke, why do the Germans not like trams? And the answer was, le tramway a deux roues, et de Gaulle et quatre roues. Bit of a joke. It has two poles, which it used for the, collecting electricity from the overhead wires, and four wheels. Little joke, which I haven't thought of since then.
Were you there when Darlan was?
I think so, yes. Yes,
you
I must have been.
The news breaking or anything?
No, because I didn't know what was going on. We were busy charging batteries and doing all sorts of things, and quite honestly, I didn't really pay much attention to the politics. What I do remember, of course, was the curious relationship with the Arabs, because at that time, the French were very much in control, and if you got talking to a Frenchman, he would, even the ones who were called les Arabissants, the people who knew Arabic, and there were quite a few who did, they were pretty contemptuous of the Arabs. It was said that they didn't do any more work than they needed to, and left to themselves, they would sit in the sun all day and not do anything. I mean, it was like that. That's one reason, obviously, it could be a reason why the Algerians are now so wildly nationalistic. But anyhow, I didn't really, and we weren't allowed to go into the Kasbah.
I was going to ask, actually, where were you billeted when you were there?
We were in a school, and the other day, another irrelevant thing, I happened to see in an Oxfam shop a map of Algiers of that time, and I bought it. But I can't see where the school was. I asked another man I'm in touch with, he was another post office man who was our instrument mechanic, and he couldn't remember. It was in a school we actually worked in, but we were billeted with an old lady in the rue Horace Vernet. He was a French painter, and that I remembered. I found that on the map, but I couldn't find, not with certainty, the school that we were in. And so how the school children got on, I don't know, but we took over the school and we had our cookhouse in the playground and the rest of it.
But you were saying you were forbidden from going to the...
Yes, the Kasbah was out of bounds, and I suppose it's because, well, I don't really know why, except that I suppose they thought that the Arabs might set upon and rob soldiers who were unwise enough to go there, so I never really went in the Kasbah.
Did you come across any hostility towards you or other British persons?
No. I reflected on that very many times when thinking about what goes on in Iraq. In those days, there were no suicide bombers, and nobody seemed to care. The Arabs picked up what... Oh, well, yes, well, on the contrary, I thought I'd learn Arabic, and I bought a little book, which I've still got, called L'Arabe sans maître. And I started to learn Arabic, but then when I found that when I started talking to an Arab, they were very pleased to talk to you, and a number of them congregated, and it became rather embarrassing, a British soldier surrounded by a dozen Arabs, and I'm sorry to say I gave it up, but instead I found, this is still in Algiers, I found an Italian emigre who had left Italy because of Mussolini, and with him I practiced Italian, and that's why I knew some Italian already from the basis of Latin, and I won't bore you with that, but I became better at it after speaking to this fellow. So after Algiers, they brought out a new unit, Air Formation Signals Unit, I can't remember, I think it was number 9, and a lot of the old timers were transferred from the old unit. I was in Air Formation Signals 2 to this new one, and unwillingly I took leave of the friends in number 2, two Air Formation Signals. I went to Tunis, where the new one was. Well, perhaps we didn't go immediately. We went anyway. I was in Tunis with them, and this was very much the same, except that we had different communications. And one of my jobs was to build a cable route, underground cable route, from the Tunis, from the signals office in Tunis, I suppose it was, the headquarters, to the airfield. And for this I was in charge of many hundreds, it seemed at the time, of Arab gentlemen who each had a card, and you stamp their card and then they get paid at the end of the week, and I had to pay them. And the only trouble was that they all seem to have the same names, like Mohammed bin Mustafa and that sort of thing, you see, and therefore you weren't quite sure whether the chap with the card was the one you were supposed to pay. And we had, and this again is something I didn't see the significance of at the time, we had a French-speaking man of Turkish origin who also spoke Arabic, and he lorded it over these Arabs, kicked them and all sorts of things. And if a chap would come up and say, you know, he would present his card, and the Turk would say, "You weren't here on Wednesday." Oh, you know, and we would do. Anyway, we got over that, and we eventually actually got this. We got this armored cable, fairly armored cable, only a very modest thing in a fairly deep trench, such as a meter, and even then didn't work properly because when lorries went over the cable. And it was on earth, gradually it would go up and down, and sometimes the cable would break. And I used to have quite a time with a test set, working out how far away you can take resistance measurements, and I was able sometimes to get with 100 yards of where the fault was. And we also had an overhead cable. Are you sure this is all relevant?
Yes, yes.
We also had overhead wires. And these, every time it rained, and it does rain in North Africa, the overhead wires misbehaved. And because we had to have communications between Bizerta, which was, and Tunis, and our chaps had to go out, get once more, find out where the fault was, climb the pole, and try to solder the joint. And another chap took over from me, he was a post office man, and he ordered that all joints should be soldered all the way from Tunis to Bizerta. And I have no idea whether this was ever done. It was a huge job, but he was quite right in principle. He also took out, I may say, a test set which I had equipped with a high voltage, which I think was more accurate, and put in an ordinary WD test set. Anyway, can we stop the thing a moment, because I was going, the unit was preparing to go to Italy, and I remember we went to Sicily first to find out where we could have a headquarters, and I arrived with a colleague, another air formation signals chap, in Sicily by air, and we went into Palermo, and we said, we didn't know quite where to go. We had a car. I think we got an Italian car. And we wanted to know where the headquarters was. So I called to an Italian soldier and said, you know, where is the commandatura? I'll take you there, he said. So we got in the car, and when we got there, he marched in to the German headquarters and said, no, sorry, to the Italian headquarters and said, "Two German officers to see you, sir." We said, no. Anyway, we then did our work in Sicily, and we also went to Sardinia after that. And there, it was just after the Italian surrender, and we went to an airport called Decimomannu, and I have actually a chit signed by the head of the airport authorizing us to use a car. I won't bother you with that. Well, I could. We've given notice. And we did the same thing, and we went round Sardinia, and you asked how the Arabs and people behaved. They behaved, the Italians were so nice. We stopped to various places to make tea. See, we had mugs and things. And can we have some hot water for tea? Oh. And they then would assemble the village. One of the places we went to was in the north coast, I think it was near Olbia, and all the villagers came, friendly as anything, and they had to have tea. We never actually filled our mugs, because they all had little cups. Anyway, all I'm recording was that they were extremely hospitable and nice. And if they'd felt inclined, they could quite easily have murdered us, because we had no escort or anything. We were just a couple of people in a jeep, you know.
When you went to Sicily, the fighting had finished there.
Yes, it had.
And What was the country like in the city? Was it still knocked about?
Can't remember. I don't know how badly marked Palermo was.
In Sardinia as well.
In Sardinia, no trace of anything. I think the Italians just gave up. And the people we met, the Italian Air Force people who we were dealing with at the Decimomannu, were really extremely friendly and hospitable. You wouldn't have thought, I mean, it's corny to say this, but you wouldn't have thought that we'd been enemies, you know, a couple of weeks before. However, we were only in Sardinia.
Martin Lamb, Reel 2. You were in Sardinia?
Yes, and we were only there for a week or two, and we must have gone back to Tunis or Algiers, whatever the headquarters was at that time. And I can't recall, to be frank, how it was that eventually I was sent to SOM, it would have been, no, the number one special force, for interview as an Italian speaker. Oh, yes, I think the Greek episode, the Greek rising of Aeoka and Elas, had already taken place. And that was a very bloody business, in which the British, of course, took a lot of casualties, and it was a very unpleasant thing. And the authorities by this time realized that the same thing could happen in Italy, and they decided to put together some administrative nuclei, I suppose, so as they could take over from the Italian, the fascist authorities and the Germans when they left. And I think it was in the summer of 42 that I first went to Monopoly. 44. Erase that. That was, it was 42, of course, we landed in North Africa, November 42. So this was 44. And I remember meeting all these odd people and in a sprawling headquarters, and I was very impressed with them. I mean, but they were obviously a pretty murderous crew who'd done some... A lot of them were, anyway. I mean, they were people who'd blown up railway lines and that sort of thing. And
do you recall any individuals at that stage?
Well, Newman was one. And there was a man, a sergeant. You mentioned how that tank outside would be a death trap. This sergeant, whose name I can't remember now, but my subconscious may retrieve it in the next 5 minutes or not, was telling me about how he'd been in tanks, and he'd gone up to a German tank that they'd hit, and it had been set on fire, and inside were some corpses, you know, incinerated corpses of the Germans. So these were real, you know, those
experience.
Sort of people it took.
Yes. Sorry? Experienced.
Yes, they were. And we were given training.
So you were earmarked right from the start for operations. You weren't...
So far as I know...
You didn't go straight into a headquarters post.
No. And I... Just a moment... I did my training in a place up from Monopoly in the hills, where I think I mentioned to you, we were in those houses, Trulli, T-R-U-L-L-I, I could never pronounce a dental R, so I still can't, but that's what they were, and we were, our Morse was refurbished, because I hadn't used Morse since I'd learnt it before. And, that's where I met the man I mentioned who'd, I think I met him there, the man who was to be parachuted into Yugoslavia, but not to Tito. And I did my training, and I went back to Monopoly, and by that time, sorry.
I was just going to say, were you introduced to various types of weapons and things like that too, can you recall?
I think we must have been. There's one thing, can we,
Okay, after your paramilitary training and signals training, you would have had your parachute training.
Yes, at about the same, I can't forget whether it was before or after, but we did the parachute training. And I think we dropped in the evening because the air was, I suppose, densest then. I don't remember quite why. And this went without incident, except I remember, well, two things. One was that the old joke was they showed us how parachutes were put together and tied up by these dutiful ladies who were doing the job. And when we were issued with the parachute, the sergeant said, "Where's your parachute? And if it doesn't open, bring it back, we'll give you another one." And that was probably an old joke. And I also remember that one man, whose name I won't mention, had to be pushed out because he suddenly got cold feet. Well, I don't know what got cold, but anyway, he had to be pushed out, but he did his jumps all right. And what I do remember is the peculiar feeling of the slipstream, because the aircraft wasn't going very fast, and it was fairly low. I think it was perhaps 500 feet or something like that. We hadn't got to drop very far, and it opened immediately because your parachute was attached to the aircraft, and therefore it opened. It was pulled open. You didn't have to do anything. And after that, after the initial rush, oh, I think there was also difficulties about my glasses. I had my glasses on. And the same sergeant, or another one, pointed out that I wouldn't have them when I landed unless I took them off, and I had to take them off and put them in my pocket. He did me a good turn. And we, after the initial slipstream had gone, you just floated down calmly in the evening air, and until you, the ground, of course, came up faster than you expected, and you rolled over. So that was the, and I think, just to show the effect of inflation, I think we got 2 and 6 a day for being qualified parachutists. This compares, I may say, with the 17 and 6 a week, which was my pay as a signalman. They gave us 15 bob 1 week and £1 the next week, you see, to save having too much change. So, they then put the missions together, and we were briefed on these missions, which, as I say, were meant to ensure some kind of civil administration. And I was to be the signals fellow for the mission which would be in or around Turin. We were for looking after Piedmonte. And the head of the mission was Colonel Stevens. Robin Richards, the naval man, I think was second in command. I can't really remember who it was. And then the other two people I do remember were Vernon, John Vernon, and Leonard Petruello, both of the psychological warfare branch, which we, I suppose, didn't take all that seriously. And I myself was going to be the signals fellow, and there was also, I think it was Corporal Barrett, a better Morse operator than I would have been, who was also, who would have been the operator. And I had on my chest a bag with, I think it was 30-odd different quartz crystals of different frequencies, because that was the way in which, I don't know what they do now, but that was the way in which you regulated the frequency. I suppose it's now digital, but in those days that's all you could do, because we had B-sets. And we also had chargers.